I'm going to go ahead and call the this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that the time is currently 2:08 p.m. on Thursday, May 11th, 2023. Present today, we have Representative Josephson, Representative Hannon, Co-Chair Representative Edgman, Representative Kronk, myself, Co-Chair Foster, and I believe some folks will be streaming in here. Before we start, just a reminder, folks can mute their cell phones. This afternoon, we'll hold introductory hearings on a few bills. First is SB 55, extending the State Medical Board and Board of Direct Entry Midwives. Just a note, this is a time-sensitive one. As I understand it, there's a sunset that's approaching. And so that's why we have this bill up before us. We're trying to prioritize bills like this that are time sensitive. So we also have House Bill 193, Internet for Schools, and then House Bill 89, the Daycare Assistance and Child Care Grant Program Bill. So first up, extending the State Medical Board and the Board of Direct Entry Midwives, presenting the bill today, we have Senator Willick. Kowski, or his aide, Ms. Mercedes Colbert. And also would like to note that we have with us Representative Cologne. And so with that, I would invite Ms. Colbert to come up to the table. And if you can present the bill, I believe Senator was here earlier from what I can tell on my notepad, but we ran a little late today on our floor meeting. Also, I'd like to recognize that we are also joined by Representative Galvin. And so with that, Ms. Colbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Mercedes Colbert, staff to Senator Willikowski, who is on the Senate floor, I believe, still at this time. Thank you for hearing Senate Bill 55. It's a pleasure to be back here in this room and see some new faces, too. I am here to present Senate Bill 55, which is a sunset bill that is to extend the termination date of the Board of Certified Direct Entry Midwives and to extend the termination date of the State Medical Board. For the direct entry midwives, state auditor had recommended it be extended 4 years. That's through June 30th, 2027. And for the State Medical Board, that is through 2031. That's an 8-year extension. And to present more further details about the audits relating to these boards, we have the legislative auditor, Chris Curtis, in the room. And we also have Sylvan Robb to speak to the fiscal notes from the department.
Great. Thank you. Also like to recognize that we're joined by Representative Ortiz, Representative Tomaszewski. And let's see here. Maybe we should just jump right into the audit here, and then we could go to questions. So with that, Ms. Chris Curtis, Legislative Auditor, if you could come up and put yourself on the tape, on the record.
Good afternoon. I'm Chris Curtis, State Auditor. In your meeting packets, you should have a sunset audit of the State Medical Board, as well as the Board of Certified Direct Entry Midwives. I'll go ahead and start with the Medical Board. So this audit concludes that the board developed and adopted regulations to protect the public, improve the licensing process, and expand access to health care during the pandemic. Further, the board served the public's interest by effectively licensing physicians, osteopaths, and podiatrists. However, emergency courtesy licenses for physician assistants were not always issued in accordance with law. We also found that this board's workload had increased substantially during the audit period. At one point, it was meeting weekly to consider pandemic-related regulations, and the number of license applications that it considered increased 28% compared to the pre-pandemic period, and that was because of physicians traveling to the state in order to help meet the need for healthcare services during the pandemic, and out-of-state practitioners providing services via technology, also referred to as telehealth. Board turnover and vacancies were common during the audit period, but even with these challenges, we found the board operated effectively, and we recommend an 8-year extension, which is the maximum allowed for in statute. There are some standard information in the audit report. On page 8 is the licensing information. As of March 2022, there were 5,878 active licenses and permits for this board. If you turn to page 10, you'll find the schedule of revenues and expenses. As of March 2022, they did have a surplus of approximately $506,000. We do make two recommendations for improvements. They begin on page 14. First, we recommend that the board's executive director ensure all board meetings are adequately public noticed. We found that 6 of 32 were not public noticed or not public noticed accurately. And then second, we recommend that the board ensure emergency regulations comply with statute. So we found that when the board established the physician assistant emergency courtesy license regulation, they did not ensure that the applicant had a collaborative plan with the supervising physician, and that is a requirement of statute. Management's response to the audit begins on page 25. The governor, the commissioner, and the board chair concur with the findings and recommendations. So overall, fairly clean audit.
Great. Thank you. Do we have any questions on this audit? See none. It's a clean audit. So with that, we'll move over to the midwives, direct entry midwives.
Okay. So this should be in your meeting packets as well. It's dated October of 2022. So we did conclude that this board did serve the public's interest by conducting its meetings in an effective manner, by supporting statutory changes when deemed necessary, and by actively working towards amending its regulations. The audit also concluded that the board and the Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing, DCBPL, staff did not consistently certify midwives and apprentice midwives in accordance with the law. Further, an investigation that concerned a potential threat to public safety was not addressed in an efficient manner. So we recommend that the legislature extend this board 4 years. That is half of the 8-year maximum allowed for in statute. So my reduced extension recommendation is based on, I believe, a need for more timely oversight of this board, given the findings, as well as in recognition of the board had some draft regulations that will significantly change how it licenses midwives in the future. The standard information, page 5, you'll find that there were 47 certified midwives and apprentice midwives as of March 2022, as of June 2022. And then on page 7, you'll find this scheduled revenues and expenses, and that shows a surplus of approximately $68,000 as of March 2022. We do make four recommendations for improvements, and they begin on page 9. So in regards to the investigations that we found were not done timely, we recommend the commissioner consult with the governor's office and other policymakers to improve the recruitment and retention of investigators. And since the recruitment and retention is a statewide problem, we believe that it should be addressed at a statewide policy level. And then the recommendation 2 is a similar recommendation in regards to improving the recruitment and retention of licensing staff, which contributed to the licensing errors we found, the turnover and vacancies. On page 11, we recommend the director work with the board to ensure the online renewal licensing application form is sufficient to monitor compliance with continuing education. That was a problem we found. It also, the application referenced incorrect regulations, which also should be cleaned up. And then Rec 4 on page 12, we recommend Office of the Governor, Boards and Commissions Director, work with the board to identify interested applicants to fill board vacancies in a timely manner. So this board is a 5-member board, and for 20 months it was down 2 positions, and for 2 months it was down 3 positions. So fairly substantial. The commissioner, the board chair, and the governor's office concur with the findings and recommendations. I do want to highlight, though, that on page 26, the chair does ask for an 8-year extension as opposed to a 4-year extension, and she makes that request because the recommendations are mainly addressed to the department and the governor's office.
Great, thank you. Representative Hammond, I think you had a question.
I did. Thank you, Chair Foster. And Ms. Curtis, you've addressed my question or framed my question that I was going to ask in that final statement, which is, I am not sure what purpose it serves us legislatively, because really there's no discussion that we shouldn't have a board to certify them, and it's not really the actions of the board that are areas of recommendation from your audit. So whether we give them 4 years or 8 years or 6 years, it's really incumbent on the agency to try and make sure it's adequately staffed and doing those in a timely fashion. And so I'm trying to figure out. I still think of myself as being fairly new, but I remember us renewing this board once before, and it seems like we're always going to be in sort of a panic to get you up a step and renew it when you're down on staff and the concerns are timeliness, but not actions of the board. So am I missing something?
Through the chair, no, I think that is a common question whenever we have recommendations addressed to the division and not the board itself. But this really is a legislative oversight mechanism. So in looking at the regulation of this particular occupation, one of the things I mentioned in my reduced recommendation is that this board is going to significantly change how it licenses midwives. And I believe because of that is one of the reasons I think we should take a look at it again earlier than later. In addition, I think it's important to keep an eye on the investigations for a board that impacts public safety, and this is the second time we've had issues with the investigations.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Thank you, Chair Foster. Can you elaborate, Ms. Curtis, on any of the communications you've had with the department about their focus and ability to address the concerns you're raising? Are they, you know, do they have more investigators? Do they have it, or is it we're going to still leave this area with the same deficits in four more years? And because I don't recollect an increase in their budget for an investigator, so my recollection is these are just positions that are unfilled, and whether we're going to be able to fill them or address them and turn those licenses around in a more timely fashion and do investigations in a more timely fashion.
Yes, through the chair. So the licensing is not necessarily timely. It has to do with not actually having the appropriate documentation, and the files are not following up on certain things, and that was attributed to turnover and vacancies. And the same thing with the licensing, the investigation. The chief investigator stated that, so this was, a particular case was a threat to public safety. We identified it in the last audit 3 years ago. No progress was made on it. And the chief investigator stated that they had an untenable workload due to a high number of cases and a high number of vacant positions. Efforts to hire were not successful. So this is a statewide issue, and whether you need a budget increase when you can't find someone to apply for a position or stay in a position, and that's kind of, it may not be a budgetary situation on whether you just need to give them an increment or whether there needs to be some more statewide policy issues as far as recruitment and retention.
Thank you.
Okay, further questions on midwives? Representative Josephson?
What is the prejudice to the board and to midwives writ large if they have to come back in 4 years? Do they pay your fees?
Through the chair, no, this is just part of our budget. That we look at what boards are sunsetting that year, and we have the resources to do those audits. That means we do more. So if there's seven sunsets in 1 year, more of our resources goes towards that as opposed to doing special audits at the request of the committee. So, there's no cost to the department for a sunset. It's just their time and energy dealing with the auditors, really.
Follow? You said no charge to the department. What I want to know is if I were a midwife or Miss Belial, the chair, why is this so important that I get 7 years instead of four?
Does it
feel insulting to them? Is that what it is?
Well, through the chair, we certainly can read their response. These folks are passionate about what they do, and these volunteers work very hard. And I time and time again, I see that they feel that it's kind of like a grade on their report. They want an A. They work really hard. And they don't feel a 4 year is an A, but I do want to acknowledge that these folks do they're doing a wonderful job. They're working really hard, and this isn't a reflection of their time.
Thank you.
Further questions? Okay, seeing no questions. Thank you very much, Ms. Curtis. So both of these boards will expire June 30 of this year unless they are extended. We've heard from our auditor. We also have the fiscal note to address. Ms. Colbert, do you have anything else before we jump into the fiscal notes?
No, Mr. Chairman, thank you. I do want to say thank you. I was remiss in saying shout out to our intern, Kaylee Spencer, who carried this bill through the other body, and I'm filling in after she's departed. So I just want to say thank you for hearing the bill now.
Great, thank you. Ms. Sylvan Robb, if you would come up and walk us through the fiscal note, OMB component 2360.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon. For the record, Sylvan Robb, Director of the Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing. So the fiscal note to extend both of these boards, you'll see the total cost is $25,200. That's consistent beginning in FY25 and out through 29. The reason that there are not costs shown related to the bill in FY24 is that per statute, if the boards are not extended, they have a one-year wind-down, so we would be paying for the board next year regardless of the status of this bill.
Great, thank you. Any questions for Ms. Robb? Seeing no questions, thank you very much, Ms. Robb. I don't know if we have any issues with this, in which case we can hold it, but if not, I would entertain a motion.
Chair Foster.
And Representative Hammond.
Can we bring Ms. Robb back to the table? So
sure. Ms. Robb?
Thank you, Chair Foster. Ms. Robb, I'm sure you heard my question to the auditor, and my concern is, how is the department doing in hiring that investigative position and filling the vacancies that have created some demerits on the audit?
Ms. Robb.
Thank you for the record, Sylvan Robb. Through the chair to Representative Hannon, we have had quite a bit of success in getting our investigations unit staffed. Until the end of March, we were fully staffed. We had all 23 positions filled. We did have an individual retire at the end of March. We have rehired for that, but it was an internal promotion, so we'll still have a vacancy, but we are doing much better in terms of having those investigation positions filled.
One follow-up?
Follow-up.
So you believe that the department will be able to support the board to fully comply with statute for the next 4 years if the sunset is extended?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, I do.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you. Okay. Well, if it is the desire of the board, I would entertain a motion to move this bill out of finance. Representative Edgman.
Mr. Co-Chair, I move Senate Bill 55, version 33-LS0347-V from the House Finance Committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Okay, seeing no objection, Senate Bill 55, version 33-LS0347-B is reported out from House Finance Committee with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal note. And if folks could please sign the yellow paper. And so with that, we will jump right into the next bill, and that is House Bill 193, that's Internet for Schools. Presenting the bill today, we have Representative Edgman. We also have Commissioner Heidi Teschner, and for the Department of Education and Early Development, the Commissioner will be available for questions, and I'd like to invite Representative Edgman to the table. Looks like we'll also have Labe Allensworth, his staff, up also, if you can both put yourselves on the record, and go ahead and begin.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Representative Bryce Edgman, House District 37.
Hello, good morning, good afternoon, everyone. Labe Allensworth, staff representative Edgman.
And Mr. Chairman, I know our time is brief, so really appreciate the opportunity to sort of present this bill by way of framing what the bill proposes to do and why the bill is even before the committee. the bill basically is to allow for better internet services to be provided for schools across the state, schools that qualify for the federal E-rate program. The E-rate program is a program that flows down through, you know, basically the Federal Communication Commission, the Universal Services Fund, all the way down into state broadband programs such as we have here in Alaska. And the matching rate is $8 to $9 for every state dollar that is put forward. So it's a program that over the years has been very successful for schools in Alaska. It's a program that sort of got its start in Alaska with the state broadband assistance program, BAG as we call it colloquially, that was put into law in 2014. At that point, it was the grant speed of 10 megabytes per second. And for those of you in the capital today that couldn't access your internet or this, that, and the other, I've been told that our speed equivalently has been about 5 megabytes per second. So if you can imagine how slow 10 megabits back in 2014 might be. 2020, the legislature upped that 10 megabits per second threshold to 25 megabits per second. And the bill you have in front of you takes that 25 megabit per second threshold and it proposes to increase it to 10 megabytes. And, you know, by way of framing, again, the issue that's before the committee, keep in mind that last year this committee heard a bill setting up the broadband office for the state of Alaska, the advisory committee, and really just sort of putting into statute the framework to open up the opportunities for a massive amount of federal money that's going to come into Alaska to provide high speed and affordable and hopefully equitable broadband services to all user groups across the state. Well, this bill, House Bill 193, sort of trailing behind it, or in some cases aligned with this big effort to bring federal money into the state, says, in the meanwhile, there's a lot of schools out there who are being hampered by slow internet and don't have the opportunity to do video conferencing, standardized testing, you know, teachers send basic emails, do assessments, do really basic coursework as it exists now in the 21st century. And this bill proposes to up the threshold again from 25 megabits per second to 100. I am told, Mr. Chairman, that there will be a vehicle from the other body possibly come to this committee in short order. So our intent today was to sort of kind of walk the committee through the big picture about what this bill wants to do and proposes to do, and be available in, you know, short order for any questions or to step aside if you want to bring others up to the table.
Thank you very much, Representative Edgeman. Do we have questions? Representative Colon.
Thank you, Chair. Through the Chair, thank you for bringing this forward. So I did the deed subcommittee, and so it's obvious that this needs to happen. The schools are really struggling. I guess my question was, you know, when I look in the chart, a lot of this is GCI and ACS. Where's Starlink in this? Can they use Starlink and use the grants? Or do they have to have certain providers to be able to use the BAG grant?
Mr. Ellensworth?
Through the chair, Representative Colom. These contracts are individually bid upon by school districts, and so school districts may choose which provider they go with. I'm not certain of where Starlink stands in that, whether or not they have the capacity to provide the amount of internet service that would be required for a school district, but these are decided on by school districts individually.
Okay, great. Thanks. That's helpful.
I think if I might add to that as well, that what this program would provide would be that flexibility to work with the GCI or ACS and also ensure that 100 megabits per second threshold includes download speeds, the signal that comes to the school, and the signal that leaves the school, the upload speed. So it's 100 on both ends. And, you know, maybe in some cases Starlink can provide that, but there are other instances where we know GCI and ACS can more reliably provide that service.
Okay. Representative Hennen.
Thank you, Chair Foster. My question has to do, Mr. Representative Edgeman, with, and I guess I was startled when I learned about this bill, that we set in statute the specific rate of download, and I am sure there is some history there, but I guess in my mind, we're going to have to change this every couple of years because no one decreases in speed needs. And I certainly know as a classroom teacher, when we got some mandatory state testing that we were all going to be able to do online, that was the downfall of being able to do it because there weren't any schools who could plug all their kids in at the same time on the same day to do a standardized test, yet that was the fantasy. And I completely support and believe we need faster internet and a grant program to do that, but I'm just wondering whether, is there a mechanism so that it's not set in statute so that every 2 or 4 years it has to come through a statutory change versus the regulation of the grant and our budget process of we're giving grants at this level, but we can adjust it without?
Representative Benjamin.
The co-chair, Representative Hannon, ideally, in short order, like the next several years, we're going to have fiber optic cable sort of available not only in the middle mile but the final mile capacity to schools far and wide. There'll be some areas, of course, that won't be able to take advantage of that. But, you know, there's a fiscal note tied to this bill that is, dare I say, a little bit eye-popping when you look at the actual number. But in order to that's a number that builds in all the schools that are out there that could qualify the program if they could get the infrastructure in place and put everything together to qualify for it. So I kind of like to think of the E-rate program as it stands now in many respects as a bridge program, so that going into the future we shouldn't have to see, you know, the 2014, 2020, 2023 sort of iterations of this bill go into the future. Maybe that's the case. There'll be some small schools that can't take advantage of all this federal broadband money coming in through the IJA Act, but that's the way that I look at it.
Thank you.
Okay, just would like to also recognize we're joined by Representative Stapp. Any further questions for Representative Edgman? Representative Galvin?
Thank you, and this is relatively new to me, although I'm familiar with E-rate and how important that is to rural Alaska for sure. But I'm new to this. I apologize for that and my lack of readiness. But I do have a couple of questions. One is, I think it says more than 20 school districts. So I presume that these are school districts that have historically used and needed an extra support for internet, is that correct?
Through the chair, that's correct. A lot of the internet has been satellite driven, or it's been through microwave transmission, maybe in some smaller instances for outlying schools, actual fiber optic cable, but that's the sort of the minority number at this point. With fiber optic cable finding its way down the Yukon into the Waikiki region here in a year or so, as certainly the Quintillion line being laid around the states and up north and to the co-chair's district and whatnot. It's something it's going to be, you know, fiber optic driven, and a lot of schools will be able to enjoy the same amount of broadband that the schools in urban Alaska provide. And by way of quick comparison, I was told a couple of days ago that the broadband that we use here in the capital is in the several hundred megabytes per second realm. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about getting a school, Nome Belts High School, for example, 500 plus students, you know, maybe 100 megabytes, you know, so we still have a lot of catching up to do. And again, I'm pretty optimistic because hopefully in the future it's not a funding source challenged as it was in the past, and, you know, we'll be able to get things in place.
Thank you. So through the chair, if I may. So what we're doing is supplementing or ensuring that at the very least, this very minimum speed is met in these school districts, and we're making sure that there's the funding there for that. Yes?
Yes, through the co-chair, to qualify through the E-rate program.
Right.
So there may be other means that schools use, but we're talking a lot of schools across the state, and my staff can provide you an exact number either now or later if you need it.
I just have a follow-up of a comment. Thank you. I know this is coming late in the game, but boy, how important this is. I know that so many districts would like to participate in opportunities for online learning, and they sign up. And I've heard again and again from teachers where they'll do that, and then, by golly, just don't happen to have enough of the bandwidth to make it happen. And so I very much appreciate that we're, like, as you say, providing a bit more equity for all of the Alaska students. Thank you.
Great. Also like to recognize that we're joined by co-chair Representative Johnson for the questions on the bill. Representative Kronk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Edgman, when I'm looking at this fiscal note, if fiber optic
we get that done, would this number go away? Would it decrease?
Through the co-chair, that's number that projects outward as if every school qualified. You got to qualify for the E-rate program, but you also have to have the infrastructure in place to participate in the delivery of service. I was talking with one of the providers this morning, and he cautioned that that's going to take time. So that number is, it's at the very ceiling of what could be out there. But in the meanwhile, like, we've got fiber optic cable going through the Dillingham region that'll be extended up into the lower YK region through the Bethel area. That's going to take some of the schools off the list that would actually compete for the E-rate money.
Thank you.
Okay, further questions? Okay, seeing no questions, any closing comments, Representative Benjamin?
Mr. Co-Chair, thank you for allowing us to bring the bill forward. I know time, again, is short. This is a pretty important issue, and I hope and look forward to maybe an additional hearing, and just presuming if the Senate vehicle comes over, maybe with a different bill in front of the committee.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Next up, we'll have House Bill 89. That's the Daycare Assistance and Child Care Grant Program. Presenting today is Representative Colon, Mayor of Staff Daniel Robbins. If you could both please come to the table. I'm going to take a very quick brief at ease. Okay, House Finance back on record at 2:42 p.m. So with that, Representative Colon, if you and your staff could put yourselves on the record and go ahead and start us off with the presentation.
All right, so good afternoon, Co-Chairs Edmund, Foster, and Johnson, and members of the House Finance Committee. Thank you for hearing HB 89. For the record, I'm Julie Colon, representative for House District 11, and with me I have my staff, Daniel Robbins, with me here at the table. HB 89 strengthens the child care system in a number of ways. It expands the number of families who can utilize daycare vouchers and aligns the subsidy level to reflect the actual cost of daycare. It makes child care expenditures and cash or equipment accepted by daycare facilities and payments to employees for the purpose of offsetting child care costs eligible for tax credits. It increases the maximum individual tax credit limit, develops a sliding fee scale to make grants less generous for higher income families and lower income families, and provides grants for the highest performing and highest quality child care facilities. So this bill, when we started the committee process, it did two things. It was to commission a study to find out the actual cost of daycare. So right now is a market survey, which is basically what people are charging now, but it's not working because obviously daycares are going under. So it's not enough for them to stay in business. So the department is doing that survey to see what the actual cost of care is, and so the bill would adjust that up in consideration of vouchers. The other thing it does is to, and I'll let my staff go through this, but basically expands the opportunity for different income levels for families to access care, larger number of families. And the reason why I'm carrying this is, you know, when I first got here, there's so many people came from the private sector that said they were really, really struggling with workforce, and one of the biggest problems was daycare. And I know in my own private work, and I ran a lot, I managed a lot of people, missed days, late, leaving early, constant problems because of the lack of childcare. So this is, I consider this not only a support for families, but certainly a support for our workforce. So if it's okay, I can hand it over to my staff, and he can run through a short slideshow and do sectional, whatever you want to do.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Daniel Robbins, staff to Representative Coulomb, and I will be presenting House Bill 89, Child Care. So the principal problem that this bill aims to address is a lack of affordable, quality child care. The reason that this lack of child care is a problem is that it worsens labor shortages, endangers children, undermines families' economic security, and decreases workforce participation. The solution to this child care problem is to strengthen the child care sector to improve access for families and help parents return to the workplace. HB 89 strengthens the child care system in a number of ways. It expands the number of families who can utilize daycare vouchers. It aligns the subsidy level to reflect the actual cost of care. It incentivizes tax breaks for employers to donate to daycare facilities. It increases the maximum tax credit. It eliminates a sudden drop-off of subsidies for higher-income families, and it provides grants to the highest quality and highest performing daycare facilities. So the problem is that Alaska's child care is in crisis as a result of low wages, labor shortages, and a declining number of child care providers. As you can see in this graph, during the height of the COVID-19 pandemic, there was a large dip in the number of child care workers, and while it has rebounded some since then, it has not, is definitely not rebounded all the way. So child care subsidies are inadequate and do not reflect the actual cost of care. This is a problem because it obviously impacts lower income families, but it also impacts middle class families as well, because if the subsidies are inadequate, and you know, the ones that are being used for the lower income families, providers are going to be losing money on providing care to lower income families, And so as a result, they are raising rates on middle-class families, which forces even middle-class families out of the workforce to have to stay home and care for children. So for subsidy eligibility, currently the eligibility threshold is 85% of the state median income. So that is $60,144 in Alaska for one earner with one child. This leaves most of the middle class without affordable care and results in labor shortages in every industry in Alaska. House Bill 89 raises that eligibility threshold to 105% of the state median income to $73,920 in Alaska for one earner with one child. The department will scale subsidy level based on need. So that's the child care program department. The expanded number of families who can afford care will result in more Alaskans going back to work. So for the calculation of the subsidy rate, right now it is based on a market survey. However, this underestimates the cost of care. This puts providers in greater financial risk, which results in kids from lower income families not being able to get adequate subsidies, which results in the rates being raised on middle income families, which prices families out of care. House Bill 89 aligns the subsidy rates with the actual cost of care, which improves financial stability and affordability for the middle class. A family with a household income of $60,000 per year should not spend more than $4,200 per year on child care costs. Today, they are spending upwards of $6,600. So parents have reported that the two biggest ways that child care issues have impacted them are having to go from full-time to part-time employment and not being able to accept a job. So Missouri has actually proposed a child care tax credit for their child care program. So that would be a tax credit to daycare facilities for making capital improvements. North Dakota has a child care program. They're actually spending over $70 million a year on theirs, and they aim to make it affordable. They want to improve availability, and they want to make it quality. So just to recap, the solution is to expand the number of families who are eligible for child care subsidies under the Child Care Program Office. This will help more parents afford child care and get back to work.
Great. Thank you very much, Representative Josephson, Galvin, and Ortiz.
Yes, through the chair. Thank you, Representative.
Before you start, can I say something, Chair?
Representative Cologne?
Through the chair, or to the chair. I just wanted to make sure everybody knew. So we had people from the department be on the phone, but I guess there's a problem with the phone system. So if you have department questions, we may have to do that for the next presentation, unless they get through. I don't know. It's been an issue today.
Great, thank you. I do see two folks who were here earlier who are not now and yeah. Might be due to schedule or time constraints with our starting the meeting later than normal. So with that, Representative Josephson.
Yes, two questions. Through the chair, Representative, thank you for the bill. The Senate has $15 million for block grants or something. How do those monies, if they prevail in their position, or is that for this program, or is it a different thing?
Through the chair to Representative Josephson, thank you for the question. So those child care grants, those are grants that actually go to the child care centers. Okay, so there's what 89 is talking about is the vouchers that parents apply for that go to the child care centers too. But these are those with the center. What you're talking about are block grants that actually just go to the centers to help subsidize the center. And, you know, one thing you have to realize if you haven't already, daycare centers are a terrible business model for profit, right? You're never going to be able to charge what you actually cost you to provide the service. And so they'll always be subsidized. And so those grants and these vouchers help make the difference. We did, some of these things that were listed were amendments that came later down in the committee process, like the tax credits and things. I'm open to other things, but the vouchers and the child care grants that you're talking about, they ultimately end up at the daycare center, but they are more direct from the department to the centers.
Yeah. The next question is easier, I think. Slide 13. Did I hear that North Dakota invests $70 million a year, or was it seven?
Through the chair, it's $70
million. Yeah.
And I think they have just a few more thousand people than we do. Is that right? Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay, in the queue, I've got Representative Galvin, Ortiz, Edgman, and Hannon. Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Chair Foster. Through the chair, thank you. And then I want to call your attention to, just for clarification, let's see, slide four. I see it says incentivizes tax breaks for employers to donate to daycare. Do you mean that tax breaks will be given to those who donate to daycare? I'm just trying to figure out what the incentivize this. The bill itself is going to say if you do donate to daycares. Is it similar to the university system, I guess is my question, because I know that we have businesses donating to the University of Alaska, and then they get a tax break. I'm assuming this is somewhat similar to that?
Through the chair, yes, this is similar. So it's tax breaks for businesses that donate to daycare centers.
Okay, so it's tax breaks to incentivize donations. That's what we're doing, is incentivizing the donations?
Correct.
Okay. I think it's just a matter of semantics. And then the other question I have, if I may, Chair Foster?
Mm-hmm.
on slide 8, you had said that it would enable... On slide 8, the number of families, it would increase the number of families to have access to child care. I wondered if there had been any data yet on this. I know that you're looking at a separate study, and perhaps you don't have that yet. But I'm wondering if you know roughly what this expansion number would look like, how many.
Through the chair to Representative Galvin, we've actually inquired with the child care program office, and they did not give us any hard numbers on how many more families this would help.
Okay, one final, if I may.
Final, Representative Galvin.
It's just a comment, and it's echoing what we heard from Representative Josephson. Over $70 million is invested in North Dakota, and this has been something that we've been experiencing for decades, and we've all known that when we put investment in the early years, particularly high quality, and I know that you've spent special attention to make sure we're following the high quality standards of early learning. But when we pay attention to that, we know from other states that they enjoy a much higher workforce. And so I just wanted to say thank you for calling our attention to North Dakota. Thank you.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, to the chair. Thank you, Representative Colon, for bringing forward this piece of legislation. Bring your attention to slide 4 of your presentation. the bottom bullet there provides grants to the highest performing quality daycare facilities. How is that determined? Who are the highest performing quality? In other words, who makes that judgment?
Through the chair to Representative Ortiz, there is actually currently there are quality standards. I'm drawing a blank on the name, but if you go to any daycare facility, they'll have it posted. There's different levels. I think it goes to 5. Currently, the maximum that there is in Alaska for any daycare facility is 3. Like, they only go up, there's only daycare facilities that go up to 3. The goal here would be through providing grants, we can maybe get to higher levels.
So through the chair, to Representative Ortiz. So this was an amendment that came later, and what it's trying to do is to incentivize, a higher quality of care. There's quite a few questions around that, and so my understanding is that there is a rating scale 1 to 5 right now, and what Mr. Robbins was talking about, each daycare has that scale, that they have a rating if they're a licensed child care. Okay, so when the amendment came forward first, I didn't want to require that yet. So in the bill, it's an option for the department that if someone is 3 and higher, they could get additional funding for performance. And part of that performance right now, what that gauges is interaction, educational opportunities, how many adults per child, nutrition, and one other thing. So it's a pretty standardized system, and I was okay with the amendment because we're not trying to implement something brand new. We would just be using what's already there to incentivize child care centers that were doing a great job. And what was referenced before is, unfortunately, right now, what was said at one of the other committee meetings is that there's no daycare center above 3 right now. And so we're trying to incentivize people to try to get a 5 rating.
Follow up. Thank you for that. So is there somebody from the department that's going around the state of Alaska to these different daycare centers and determining that so far nobody's above number 3? Is that what's been determined?
Representative Ortiz, that's my understanding. And when we get the department on here, they could probably give you more details. I guess we have someone.
If you could please come up and put yourself on the record.
For the record, Heather Carpenter, Healthcare Policy Advisor at the Department of Health, and I apologize for my delay. I was running across the street from grand jury duty as soon as that finished. Through the chair to Representative Ortiz, when we think about how we are looking at the grant portion of child care and subsidizing high quality and how we're looking at that, we have metrics, some metrics we follow. Unfortunately, our expert in the program couldn't connect today to committee. We can provide a little bit more, but I do want to highlight that this is an area the department is going to dive into more, and it's something that it's part of why the governor created the task force to look at child care and task the department with how do we stabilize this sector? What do we need to look at when we're considering how we're reimbursing things like quality? And I think it's important to remember when you're looking at child care and who the state licenses, this is everyone from a small provider in a home that might be taking care of a couple of children to the facility that's next door in the Tom Stewart building that might be, serving a lot more children. So it's definitely different levels, and we want to think about that when we're applying quality metrics. So it's never a simple answer. I would say childcare is an incredibly complicated sector when you're thinking about the levers and options that you want to look at.
One more final question. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, going to a different direction here. The sense of offering tax credits. So that assumes that child care providers are paying some tax. In what form? Like, even the smaller ones are paying a tax that they may qualify for a credit for? Or are these just corporate centers that pay corporate taxes that they get a credit on?
Through the chair to Representative Ortiz. So these tax credits are actually for businesses who provide any kind of assistance to daycares, daycare facilities, for instance, like capital improvements, things like that.
Can I add something?
Representative
To the chair, Representative Ortiz. So it's a corporate tax. So in my mind, the way the amendment came forward, it was more like if you had, you know, a ConocoPhillips that wanted to have a child care center in their building or were helping their families pay for their child care. You're correct. When they're small businesses, I'm not aware of any of those tax credits. I mean taxes.
Final follow-up. Thank you. So at least the tax credit portion of it as it stands right now under the bill, the smaller businesses, the smaller providers won't necessarily be able to benefit from that. Is that correct?
Through the chair to Representative Ortiz, that's my understanding. There won't be a lot of opportunities for that to be used. I think it's case by case, too. It kind of depends on the center that they're providing, and, you know, it's going to be, I guess when I saw the amendment, I looked at it for the bigger corporations that were helping. Yeah.
Thank you.
Representative Edgman.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I did have a question or two in there, but it was asked along the way. But just quickly, I want to thank Representative Colon for putting this bill forward. I think it's one of the more innovative bills that we are going to see this session. I just sit here jotted down a couple of notes. Alaska has huge out-migration, significant out-migration challenges, especially with younger people, younger families. I think this bill and the task force, and hopefully whatever resources remain in the budget when it's all said and done, can really contribute with that outflow. It's interesting, in my conversations with the statewide association some months ago, they talked about wages in a day child care center being somewhere in the $12, $13 an hour range, and you just can't compete. When you can go to Walmart right now and get a job at $18, $20 an hour to be at the front desk, the front counter, if you will. So I guess I would also close that the summit that a number of us were at, I think half the committee or more was at on February 5th here at the Hunt Institute Summit, really talked about how Virginia and Mississippi and North Dakota are making child care assistance integral part of their workforce development in their states, not just child care, but it's an economic development tool, bar none. So I think this is one of those sleeper issues. I hope the bill gets swift consideration, and I really appreciate you bringing it forward.
Can I comment? Through the chair, Representative Edgman, thank you for those comments. I was just watching a Ways and Means Committee meeting just a couple of days ago, and there was someone that represented the Kenai economic community, the private sector community, and there were three things. He said there's three things we need government to solve: daycare, transportation, and housing. And so everywhere I go, everybody from the private sector is saying daycare. Obviously, there's issues with the public sector, too, but it is, I really consider it a workforce issue and a pro-family. You know, I think the direction the governor's been doing, wanting to make our state a pro-family, pro-life state, this is part of that. So that's how I look at it.
Thank you. I'd like to recognize that we're also joined by Representative Fields in the audience. Thanks for joining us. In the queue, I've got Representative Hannon, Tomaszewski, and staff. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Foster. Representative Colon, let me echo everyone else. Thank you for taking on what is a very Rubik's Cube, Gordian knot kind of problem. And I guess I'm going to start with the tax incentive tax breaks. I'm old enough to remember in the early 90s, you know, high-tech companies were competing for a limited work pool by saying, and my corporation offers childcare on premises. And for a while, we saw hospitals and corporations in doing this. I am wondering, in constructing that area of a tax incentive, whether you heard from, because we don't really have that many corporate payers of taxes at a high enough level to contemplate it, but whether did you hear from them that this is enough incentive that they would think about putting an on-premise facility
for their workforce, or?
So through the chair, Representative Hannon, I did not talk to them personally. I guess because I've talked to so many businesses that I thought that they would jump at the chance to help with people to get more steady daycare. So I did not talk to them one-on-one.
Thank you. And my next question has to do with, there's a legal memo in here about us changing the rate, and especially I know that you referenced the market survey versus actual cost of care. My very first problem as a newly elected was that the only daycare in Juneau who had responded to the most recent market survey that set the rates for the next 2 years was not adequate. It was the school district reporting from the wrong kind of care, but then that rate was set in, and the cycle was, you can't change it for 2 years. It's the feds. That's the rate. That's all we can pay. So I'm wanting to know whether this ties us up in a knot and gets us into a problem with our federal subsidies into the program. If we go from a market survey that it was implied to me for 2 or 3 years, the feds mandate that you must do this market survey based on respondents, not what the actual cost of care is, and whether that cost of care study is already in place or it's something that the bill dictates the department to do.
For the record, Heather Carpenter, Department of Health, through the chair, Representative Hannon. I know our office worked very closely with the entire Juneau delegation on that issue. It's one of my first issues when I moved over to the department. So to answer the questions, currently there's two methodologies, the federal government, so this is through ACF, the Administration for Children and Families, allows us to use. The market rate survey is one. An actual cost of care methodology is the other one. The intention, and again, facilitated by the work of the task force and the work of the commissioner, is we want to see if we can set up a cost of care analysis. We need to do that work, have actuarial help, really make sure we set up that methodology, and that methodology would have to be approved by the feds. Our intention is to keep going with the market rate survey while we're doing that, so we can still ensure we're looking at those rates and bringing those, more up to date as we go. So our plan is to really see, is that the better way to pay for care? In terms of, are we locked in? So the feds give us that option. Of course, it has to be approved. And I think your other question was in regards to the legal memo that Ledge Legal put out about increasing the threshold paid here. The federal government and the block awards we get through ACF, like I said, the Administration for Children and Families, caps us to paying for that care to 85% of the state median income. So all that means is that anything that is above that, so in this bill that would be 86% to 105% of state medium income, would have to be covered by general funds only.
One follow-up?
Follow-up.
And does the fiscal note for this bill reflect that, or it's reflecting the cost of a study to figure out how many people would be in that new gap area?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, I am glad you brought up the fiscal note. It does not currently estimate what that's going to cost. So a little bit of a issue with the template of the fiscal note, we couldn't add an indeterminate on the front page of the grants line. It doesn't allow that. We did show the cost of the positions we would need to do this, and we noted in this page that would be indeterminate. Part of what's hard for us to estimate those costs is we don't know how many families would enroll given that. And one context I wanted to share with the committee is we do know, so right now we have about, and it was February figures, 2,739 children that are getting subsidies through the Child Care Program Office. So total children. The number of those kids who were serving at that highest rate, so 75% to 85% of state median income, was 96. So that's about 3%. And part of that reason is the more income you have, the higher the copay the family pays. And they may have other choices about why, you know, they may have a parent who's staying home with those kiddos. There could be a number of things. And we just don't know if this is going to be enough to incentivize. I will note that right now, nothing in this bill directly directs us to increase or decrease the co-pays the families are paying. And it is currently on a sliding scale. So that is one of those policy levers that you all can choose to direct or ask us to look at. But I think it really warrants a conversation as when you are making more money, is that copay affordable or is it not?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would just close with, I think one of the downsides that a fiscal note does is not show us the costs, the lost economic costs that Alaska is having by having inadequate child care and people not being able to go to work. So I appreciate your efforts on this. It won't be a single fiscal note, but I want to just footnote for us all now. The cost of doing more child care creates an economic wheel that we will generate more revenue into Alaska and have more Alaskans working when we have child care that serves the families who need it, and that benefits all of us. So thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That would be a very, I think, interesting and something I would like to see, although it would be hard to quantify, but a nice little new section on the fiscal notes. So with that, next up I've got Representative Tomaszewski and then Representative Stapp.
Co-Chair Foster, through the chair, those who are covered now, the up to 85% of the state median income, you said there's about 2,700, is that correct? And can you tell us how much that is costing the state in general funds and the feds in federal funds as it sits right now?
Through the chair, I don't have that number right in front of me, and I apologize because the program director absolutely would, but I can tell you it is all federal funds. It is paid through our block grant through the federal government.
So it's zero general and
correct.
All federal funds, but then anything after the 85 through the 105 is going to be all general funds?
That is correct.
Okay, can you just walk us through one of these real
sure.
quick?
The let me pull out my. So what you're holding up is, and I apologize for the small print. I know it's significantly easier to see online, but that is the chart that shows per state median income and how many family members you might have in your house. What your copay would be. So if you are at the lowest of state median income, say 1%, you're going to have a 1% copay. So if you are, a single mom, and when it says two parent or two people in that first column, that means a two-person household. To qualify, you clearly need to be a two-person household at least, so parent and one child. That copay amount, you know, is going to be a dollar. As it goes up, it goes by percentage up to that 85%. So again, just sticking in that two-person household, you could make $5,012 a month, and you're going to pay 9% of your income towards that copay. And so that, you know, on here is $451 a month. So what that means and how the program works, when the program is paying a subsidy and we're working with a daycare who's enrolled with the child care program office, we take out that copay that the parent should pay, and then we pay the rate directly to the child care facility. And I will just note that what we're helping to support and pay for that family, so them paying for their child care being enrolled, is separate than the grant program that is also contemplated in the bill.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Stapp.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Through the chair, to Representative Cologne and maybe Ms. Carpenter as well. First, Representative Cologne, just want to thank you. This is a really interesting and innovative bill to tackle a very challenging issue. I do have a couple of concerns with some of the sections in the bill. So when I think in terms of the long-term fiscal impact, specifically to the tripling of the existing tax credit, The bill states that after 2030, a five-year basically rolling inclusion of inflation indexed to, in the text in it says, the consumer price index for all urban consumers for urban Alaska is basically going to be automatically baked into the cake of the nature of these tax subsidies or credits from now until perpetuity, right? So in my mind, that when you index something directly to inflation, especially CPI for urban Alaska, like typically CPI is tied to kind of an Anchorage rate, and not obviously the CPI is very different at Fairbanks and Juneau than it is from Anchorage, that one creates it pretty difficult to calculate a long-term fiscal note. And two, I would be pretty, just on a personal level, I don't see how you'd be able to actuarialize the cost out with that provision of the bill. So I'm just curious what you think.
Just for the record, Heather Carpenter, Department of Health, that section is not something that's overseen by our department, so it wouldn't be appropriate for me to comment.
That's fine.
Yeah, through the chair to representative staff. So this came up in one of the other committee meetings. So the results of are you talking about page 7?
There's in the right place. Through the chair to representative. Yeah. Yeah, it's page 3, 7. It's repeating language. I think 3, 6, 9, 12, 15, 18, 21 is repetitive language, different subsections. Line 11.
Okay.
Yeah, line 11 to 16.
So you're concerned, through the chair to representative staff, so you're concerned that it's connected to inflation? Is that your main, are you just, the amount of credits exceeding, is that what you're concerned about?
Yeah, through the chair to representative Colum, correct. Effectively, it's the increases on autopilot in perpetuity.
So, yeah, this has been, when it came up in committee, this is actually under what has been in the past, the amount. And I guess I would have to get back with you the specifics on the why it's in perpetuity. That didn't come up in the other committee meeting, but I can look at it, because I think that's a valid concern, and I have no problem getting back to you about it, and we'll look at that.
Thanks.
Okay. I don't have anybody else in the queue. So with that, we do have invited testimony from Jen Griffiths, Executive Director for Thread Alaska. Ms. Griffiths, if you can put yourself on the record and go ahead and give us your testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Coach Foster and House Finance Committee members. For the record, my name is Jen Griffiths, the Public Policy Manager for Thread. And I just want to thank you for the opportunity to testify about the current challenges facing families and child care providers and how House Bill 89 can help address some of those challenges. Thread is a statewide nonprofit that has been serving the child care sector in Alaska for over 35 years. We provide direct services to families, early educators, and child care programs across the state. As you've heard throughout the session, child care has been struggling. Well, it's not a new struggle. It's always been a challenge to find and afford quality child care. It is a struggle that is increasing as early educators continue to leave the workforce and child care programs continue to close. This continued decline in child care availability is having a significant impact on the workforce challenges in other sectors and broader economic impacts as well. Historically, the statewide gap between the need for childcare and the availability within all early education settings in Alaska has been about 20%. But since the pandemic, the challenges facing the childcare sector have increased, primarily related to attracting and retaining workforce. Thread's working to update our data regarding the current gap in early education, but the self-reporting that we're hearing from various programs and communities across the state indicate that some are experiencing declines in their enrolled capacity as high as 40% due to workforce shortages. This decline in capacity has resulted in classroom and program closures that further restricts the supply of available child care. Federal stabilization funds during the pandemic provided support to child care providers, But these funds that were delivered in three phases, the last of those funds were distributed in April. Data from the impact of those funds is being gathered, but our preliminary analysis shows that those $50 million in stabilization funds that went directly to childcare providers kept childcare businesses open that would have otherwise closed. So we know that investment worked, but we also know that it's not enough to keep programs open or early educators in the field. So THREDS advocating for additional direct support, but we also believe that creating a more stable childcare sector requires shifts in the current policies around Alaska's childcare assistance program. And that's what House Bill 89 does. It addresses two of these policy shifts, increasing income eligibility for the childcare assistance program and including a cost of care model in the determination for provider reimbursement. Currently, the income eligibility is at 85%. Increasing this would allow more families to participate in childcare assistance and increase the workforce. Additionally, childcare providers that are currently reimbursed at the rate set by the market price survey, and as you heard, that's based on the amount that they charge for care, not what it actually costs to provide high-quality care. When systems base childcare policies, including the reimbursement rate on the market price survey alone, that doesn't consider the true cost of care, it creates an unstable foundation for childcare systems, a foundation that, as we've witnessed, will struggle to weather economic and societal pressures. Including that cost of care analysis will help provide a more stable system. THREDS believes that stabilizing Alaska's childcare system and supporting the workforce requires policies that both reduce costs for parents and increase support for providers. These are the foundation of House Bill 89, which also acknowledges the need for high-quality childcare programs. We appreciate the sponsor bringing this bill forward and continuing the conversation about childcare policy. Thank you so much for the opportunity to testify and for your continued support for Alaska's children and families.
Great. Thank you very much. Before we go to questions, possibly for Ms. Griffiths, just want to recognize in the audience we've got with us Representative Armstrong, Representative Ruffridge, and Representative Sumner. So thanks for joining us. And so with that, do we have any questions for Ms. Griffiths? I don't see any questions, so thank you very much for your testimony. So with that, we'll go to wrap up. Representative Cologne.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Foster. So thank you for listening to the bill. The only thing I'd like to add is I've had some people come up to me and they're concerned about the government taking over child care. They think parents should be staying home with their children. And I agree that is the optimal situation. But things have changed. They're much different than when I was raising my kids. When I was raising my kids, there was enough stay-at-home moms that we all kind of just swapped and the community took care of business. Now my street is completely empty during the day because everybody's at work. It's not that I want to build a bunch of government-run daycares. What I'm trying to do is to tackle the problems of daycare, and I'm open to creative ideas. It's not all one thing. And I think some communities will have mom-and-pop daycares that will be taking care of kiddos. Even this committee passed an amendment that Representative Galvin had. She had a great idea to help fund some mom-and-pop's smaller daycare. So this is, and I've always said this in every committee, this is a working document. If you see, if you have ideas, if you have things you want to amend, I want to make it the best bill possible. Try to meet the most needs. That's where the tax credits come from. That's where we're trying to get creative solution. How can we partner with the private sector? How can we help little daycares? How can we subsidize the larger daycares, and how can we get the quality up? So I just appreciate your time and your questions, and I hope that everybody, I think everybody around in the committee knows that this is a serious issue that needs to be addressed.
Great. Thank you very much. So with that, appreciate your presenting the bill. You might want to get a pen and paper out here. I'm going to announce four amendment deadlines. We are at the last, I believe, 6 days of session now, and so things will be moving a little quickly, and so setting four amendment deadlines in there for the following bills. HB 178 for the Village Safe Water Facilities would like to set an amendment deadline for tomorrow, which is Friday, May 12th at 5 p.m. And then also for the same time, HB 112, which is Profession of Pharmacy. That's again for Friday. I have Friday at 12 p.m., and then it also says May 12th at 5 p.m., so maybe I'll wait for a note to come up from my staff here. The next bill is Senate Bill 77, which is Municipal Property Tax Exemption and Blighted Property, and the amendment deadline is tomorrow, Friday, May 12th at 5 p.m., and then SB 81, which is Office of Victims' Rights Compensation, we'll set that for also for Friday, May 12th at 5 p.m. I think... Let's see what this note says here. 5 p.m. It looks like I think I could have just said all four of these bills have the same amendment deadline, Friday, May 12th at 5 p.m. So, again, that last one was SB 81, Office of Victims' Rights Compensation. So, with that, rather than adjourn for today, we are going to recess until tomorrow at 8 a.m. We're doing that as a just-in-case. We don't have a plan, but there are a number of meetings that were recently canceled just due to floor session and other meetings. So we may fit something into that time slot, and we may not. So we'll try to let folks know as soon as possible. Representative Hannon?
So, Mr. Chairman, my question is, when do you think you'll know? Because I have an 8 a.m. that is off-site, and I'd need to cancel with them if I'm not going to show or let them know. But we'll know this evening or not till the morning?
I have a 4 o'clock meeting to address that, so hopefully we'll know no later than 5 o'clock, right. Preferably sooner, maybe 4:30. So we'll let you know. Any other questions of the committee, Representative Ortiz?
Real quickly, Mr. Chair. I missed something because you said there were 4 bills with the deadline for tomorrow, and I only got 3, 178, 77, and 81.
I thought maybe I jumped the gun on that. Thanks for bringing that up. So I'm going to restate all 4 bills. It's HB 178, which is the Village Safe Water Bill, HB 112, which is Profession of Pharmacy, SB 77, which is Municipal Property Tax Exemption and Blighted Property, and then the fourth is SB 81, which is Office of Victims' Rights Compensation, and that would be for the attorneys that we accidentally left out in last year's action that we took. So with that, if there's nothing else to come for the committee, we'll be recessed at 3:30 p.m. Thank you.